Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Interesting little news bites before we go to battlefield study today. Associated Press is reporting. All right, this is going to shock you, but try to hold on. Chemical weapons watchdogs confirms sarin gas and chlorine gas were very likely used in March 2017 attacks in Syria. Well, there's a surprise. Nobody thought that was the truth. Here's another one. Nice impersonation of a German Mickey Mouse. I couldn't do it. I tried. I did my best, man. That's not an easy impersonation to do, right? The hummingbird people, the German hummingbird people. Yeah, there you have it. Wait, there was one more. There was one more thing I was going to say. Oh, well, must have been a lie, right? So my mom always said, where does that come from? If you forget something, it was a lie? How about if you're just, maybe I'm just forgetful, Mom. See, that was that constantly negative way that we were raised. Yeah, you're a bad kid. It was a lie. Blah, 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 blah. All right. Battlefield study today. First Light Armored Reconnaissance Company. First Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion in 2002-2003 time frame. Lieutenant Colonel at the time, Duffy White. He will go on to become regimental commander of the 3rd Marine Regiment. He will take it and deploy to Afghanistan, first time 3rd Marine Regiment headquarters element deployed during the Iraq or Afghan War. So Duffy did that. I first crossed paths with him at the basic school, teaching there, he and I. He is salty-ass, mouthy first lieutenant, but really funny because he's a southern guy and he does funny impersonations. So with that said, battlefield study today. It's about 2 hours long, so don't be afraid to pause it. Do whatever you have to do. As they all are, good shit. If you go to the website, if you click on the battlefield studies page, and you click on part one, you will find all the maps and the link to the 1st LAR Battalion Association on there. They're raising money for a wall that they intend to build at Camp Pendleton. So there's a grand total of five maps and 3 pictures that are in that stuff, so you can go ahead and check that stuff out. So, with that said, and in about an hour, if you click on the pictures, they will expand. Haven't got that far yet, so I will, right after this. Duffy White, in his own words, battlefield study.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You know, when you hear country music, you know that an American is coming on the program. Joining me now is an American from Tupelo, Mississippi, by way of Memphis State College. Otherwise, the Duffy White, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, infantryman, commander of 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion, as well as 3rd Marine Regiment, and a veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan. Duffy's been on the program before, so Duff, welcome home. Thanks for doing this, and thanks for being part of the awesome battlefield studies thing that we do here on All Marine Radio.
Hey, Mac, thanks for having me back, and it really is a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay. The just so if you've never listened to one of these, the purpose in these is to kind of walk you through, using maps, the problem that confronted 1 MEF in the 1st Marine Division and the commanders of those organizations, that organization, as during from 2002 to 2003 when they executed the march up from Kuwait to Baghdad. And so that if you do pay attention and you do kind of follow along, you can learn lessons about combat that you can't learn outside of it. And I think the voice, the spoken word, is much more powerful than the written word, because you hear inflection, you hear tone, you hear emotion at time, and I think it will benefit you as a professional to listen to these. So there are, and I will tell you, they're all awesome. They're from different perspectives, guys from different ranks, and today Duffy's will be from the perspective of a lieutenant colonel battalion commander. So Duff, give us the 5 to 10 minute thumbnail on your career.
All right, Mac. I joined the Marine Corps through the platoon leaders class program. I went to 3 different colleges, so luckily I was able to go to PLC junior and PLC senior. Actually, 36 years ago, I was at PLC junior in the summer of 82, then went back to senior summer of 83, finally got commissioned in 84, and of course I was a nasty reserve commission guy, so the Marine Corps didn't bring me on active duty until they absolutely had to. So, we reported in to basic school in November of 84, wound up getting selected for infantry and first duty station Wish of Hawaii. So went out to the old 1st Marine Brigade, 3rd Marine Regiment, minus reinforced. And that used to be the best deal in the whole Marine Corps. They would do the Westpac floats, kangaroo floats, they call them. And as soon as I got my orders there, they said, "Oh, that's the last Westpac out of Hawaii. You guys are going to start doing UDP to Camp Hansen."
Yeah.
So I got to experience 2 of those. But I will tell you, it was really, really a great learning experience. One of my rotations in the 9th Marines, regimental commander, was then Colonel Zinni. And really, you know, kind of, I think everything he said was kind of like a splash of cold water in my face, like, I've never heard anybody talk like this before. I think I might need to pay attention. And, my first regimental commander at 3rd Marines was then Colonel Christmas, Navy Cross recipient, Battle of Lee City, and his Sergeant Major was Sergeant Major Kellogg, Medal of Honor recipient. Got it for jumping on a grenade in the firefight in the paddies in Vietnam, and luckily the paddy absorbed a lot of the blast, so it didn't kill him. But you know, those were the kind of leaders that when you and I were junior officers, you know, we were under, and you just assumed everybody was that squared away, that smart, that heroic on the battlefield, and we those guys, it seemed to go away really quick.
Right.
And so at that point in the Marine Corps, I wound up getting augmented, which was I don't want to go through a long story, but I was the only guy out of 3rd Marine Regiment that got augmented and got to keep my original infantry MOS.
That didn't happen. Didn't happen.
Yeah.
Didn't happen.
So, no. Wow. No, it was just, good circumstances lined up for me, but I wound up then going back to the basic school to be a tactics instructor initially, and that's where I met Mac. He came in as a salty seagoing captain. I was still slugging it out in my fifth year as a commissioned officer, or still a first lieutenant, but wound up I guess in Third Marines. I was a rifle platoon commander, 81's platoon commander, company commander of golf company, and then company commander of H&S company. So a little over almost 3.5 years, they never sent me to a school. They never did anything but just let me lead Marines. And Hawaii was unique in that there wasn't a big division like, you know, at Pendleton or Lejeune or even 29 Palms, where there's just a constant flow of new guys coming in. And so your time in those key billets in your formative years, you got a limited time because somebody else, you know, the next guy in, because Marine Corps is so cheap, they don't send anybody to Hawaii until they're supposed to leave. So if somebody leaves early, that opens up a hole.
Right.
And so, it really did turn out to be the best place for me to kind of learn my craft. And then I thought, you know, I knew everything until I got to TBS and tactics instructor, Lieutenant Colonel Ray Cole. You're like, holy crap, I didn't know anything. But the fortunate thing for us was the Marine Corps Commandant at the time, Al Gray, was like, hey, we are going to adopt, maneuver warfare, and we're going to, inject it into every new officer's head at TBS. So you got to reprogram, retool, refit the entire program of instruction for 6 months. So we were, teaching and retooling and learning all at the same time. So it really, I felt like we got a master's degree in Marine Corpsology, just being on the staff at that time. And it was not unique for me and you, Mac. It was, I think everybody felt that way. And it really did planted a really good, foundation for us. Then after that, after my tour there, they sent me to Advanced Armor School, because every tanker and Amtrak in the Marine Corps was in Saudi Arabia for the build-up at Desert Shield. And the Marine Corps was so cheap, they had bought seats for Advanced Armor School, and they weren't going to let those go unfilled. So they pulled a couple of those infantry guys to go to Advanced Armor School. And hey, you're going to do a payback tour in the LAR battalion. Back then it was LAI, Light Armored Infantry. And I'm like, well, I don't want to do that, but it turned out once again to be one of the best things that ever happened to me.
I just made fun of Mac for 2 years, calling him not really an infantry guy because he split his time between 1-5 and 1st LAR at the time. Yeah, I just did that. Yeah. And if he finds out that I went to an LAR unit, it's not going to be good. It's not going to be pretty, because he's not that kind of guy to let something like that go.
But, that's where they put all the forward-thinking infantry officers. as a matter of fact, when I got there, Ray Cole was my battalion commander, and then John Kelly came in to be, my next battalion commander. So it really was, and at the time, they had really proven themselves in the Great Gulf War. And the flexibility, at that point, we had been sending out reinforced platoons with the Westpac BLTs and the MUs that were going out, and the more the MU commanders learned about them, the more LAVs they wanted. So we started sending out company minuses, and that was unique in the Marine Corps. And they're virtually on almost every mission. The LAVs were pre-boated on the LCATs, on the LSDs, and really were built into almost every operational scenario. And it really, for first LAR, it really kind of pumped everybody up, because they were going to they knew they were going to get there, get in the company, get trained up and join a BLT and get those West packs. So we really, you know, got a lot of operational, you know, exercise experience, but it was real, you know, doing stuff, being ready to do your job. And then after that, I got a chance to do a next tour at 3rd Marine Division, where I joined 9th Marine Regiment until they rolled up the colors there, the Striking 9th. And then I joined 4th Marine Regiment up at Camp Schwab, both as the assistant opso of the regiments. And so it really did get me back into, you know, immersion in you know, all things, you know, foot mobile infantry related. And there was a unique battalion at in 3rd Marine Division called the Combat Assault Battalion that husbanded all the Amtraks, LAVs, and combat engineers of the whole division into one battalion. And there was the OPSO billet was for an LAV officer. So I was the only permanently assigned infantry guy at 3rd Marine Division that had any sort of LAV background. So I got that job for 2 years. And so, wow. And, you know, even before I was selected for major. So it really did just, you know, doing those things that opened up doors for me. And one of the things we did was we got a no-notice tasker to reinforce 13th MU and to provide a command ship for then Lieutenant General Zinni, as he was the commander of the Joint Combined Task Force, to do the covering force withdrawal from Mogadishu, Somalia, of the UN. And so I got to be the OPSO for the Special Purpose MAGTAF that left out of 3MEF Okinawa and sailed there to Somalia. And, great experiences from there. Then I went to Command and Staff College, did a joint tour at the White House. After that, still wasn't selected for the Lieutenant Colonel, wasn't even in zone yet. So they sent me to Headquarters Marine Corps Plans, Policies, and Operations and put me as they said, hey, there's a infantry billet there. So the infantry occupational field sponsor. And they're like, but you also do LAV stuff. So I'm like, okay, we got that. And then also wound up doing recon stuff. And then I did get promoted, and then they formed a new branch called MAGTAF Special Ops and Recon Branch. And at the time, it was General Jones was the commandant, and we were doing a lot of big initiatives within the headquarters to fix reconnaissance and fix the MUSOC. And so I was kind of doing some staff action work in there. And one of the things that I did was helped stand up the operational advisory groups for both LAR and infantry. And as it turns out, I was selected for command of 1st LAR in that tour, and then went out in early summer of 2001 and took command. So from 2001 to 2003, after we got back from the OIF-1 fight that we'll discuss here in a little bit. And from there, got sent to Naval War College. From Naval War College, got sent to the combined NAVIER 6th Fleet Staff as the Deputy Plans Director and the Fleet Marine Officer for 6th Fleet. From there, got selected for Colonel and went out to 3rd Marine Regiment where I started, you know, as a lieutenant. So it was really, really interesting, you know, getting to go back, you know, 20 years later. And at the time, 3rd Marine Regiment was the only regimental headquarters, I think, artillery and infantry, that had not deployed to the big fight. And General Neller was actually took over as CG from General Robeson. And, you know, he's like, all right, what do you want? I said, I think it's a shame, you know, the battalions are deploying their ass off and the regimental command, you know, headquarters haven't gotten a chance to deploy. And as it turns out, you know, we wound up deploying as the command element for the Special Purpose MAGTAF Afghanistan in late 2008. And if your listeners would remember, it was a time when piece had broken out in Al-Anbar. We broke in the back there, and the Marine Corps had 24MU and Task Force 27 in Afghanistan, but everything else in Al-Anbar we were trying to, you know, ramp down, and the Marine Corps needed to maintain a presence in Afghanistan at the end of 24MU and 27's deployments there, and so they formed, you know, kind of no notice, the Special Purpose MACDAF in Afghanistan, and that's where we fit in there for the first 7 months, and at the whole time then Second MEB was ramping up to then deploy over as Task Force Leatherneck, and then I did a transfer of authority relief in place with General Nicholson, Larry Nicholson, and then I reflagged from the command element to be the regimental combat team for the Second MEB Task Force Leatherneck for the next 5 months of my deployment there. Deployed back to Hawaii, and then they sent me to NATO headquarters for the last 3.5 years of my command. You know, that's a quick 30 years. You know, goes by fast, Mac.
There you go, 30 years, the Reader's Digest edition. All right, Duff, I want to talk about you at First LAR, and then the notification that you guys are going to go, and the spooling at Camp Pendleton, and specifically, I'd like you to focus on when you talk about it. What were the things that you focused on as a commander in order to get your guys ready to go? So talk about that period of time when the division gets notified, hey, we're going to do this, and what was that like? What did you focus on?
All right, just a little preface for that. I was, with the battalion just on a normally scheduled training, 3 weeks up at 29 Palms when 9/11 happened. General Conway was the division commander then, and, you know, literally I called back from 29 Palms back to Pendleton like, hey, sir, what should we do? He's like, hey, Duff, I think you're in the best place you know, for you. Just stay up there and train. Come back when you're supposed to. And, when they figure out who's behind this, I'm sure we're all going to be in the fight. Actually, one of my companies was out with the MUSOC that got sent to do the initial invasion of southern Afghanistan with General Mattison, the whole Task Force 58.
Wow.
Tom M. Pelletieri, and they actually, with the LAVs, landed down into the southern LZ, LZ Rhino, and then led the attack into Kandahar, seized Kandahar airfield, and had, I think it was first Marine, conventional Marine, that they went up there. Some scouts were providing security for EOD and stepped on a smart mine, blew his leg off, lower leg, and injured the guys in front of him and behind him. And it turns out he was able to re-enlist, and years down the road I saw where he had graduated from jump school with one leg.
Wow.
And it was all General Conway's doing.
Awesome.
But literally from at 9/11 to next thing you know, holy crap, we got a company in Afghanistan fighting. The entire battalion kind of had a very focused, I think we had everybody's attention, and a lot of the bullshit seemed to go away, and a lot of probably behavior issues and things like that. Hey guys, I don't know when we're going, but we're going. You know, we're already halfway over there, you know, and so I think everybody wanted to go. And so that was kind of I didn't have anything to compare it to beforehand,
right.
You know, but the battalion was still manning, forming, equipping, training, certifying the companies to go out with the West Coast BLTs, but now there was a chance for the whole battalion to go. And so, General Conway finishes his tour. During that time, I mean, the division staff was very focused on fighting the division.
Okay.
We were doing a bunch of, big long COMEXs and computer generated exercises and actually, doing live fire stuff at 29 Palms as a division, you know, and as the units, and really had gotten to know then the other battalion commanders and regimental commanders. And General Mattis comes in to take General Conway's spot in the summer of 2002.
Okay, can I ask you just a question? I mean,
yes.
All right, so
yes.
You took over the battalion when?
It was the 3rd of July of 2001.
Okay, so you take over in July of 2001. When do you deploy to Kuwait?
January of 2003. But literally since September, we knew we were going somewhere.
Okay, did you know that they were going to keep you in command? How long was your command supposed to be? Because
it was, I knew I was going to be in command for 2 years.
Okay.
And that's what a lot of people were, a lot of commanders were like, oh crap,
right.
I don't want my command to end before.
Yeah, no
kidding. But it had been 2 years, although the guy that I replaced was only there for a year and a half. He left a little bit early to go to school. So, but I was kind of in there, and then, if I didn't get fired, I was going to, get the chance. And so, at that point, as we discussed, I'd never been to combat, real combat. Here I was, been in the Marine Corps for 18 years at that point.
And that was just about the case for everybody, right? I mean, the people that were lucky, got involved in humanitarian stuff. I mean, the guys that were lucky went ashore in Somalia. But, and there were instances where people got shot and Marines got killed. But, I mean, if you ask most professionals, have you ever gone to combat, they would have said, well, kind of, sort of, but not really. And those were the lucky ones. And even the guys who are in Desert Storm, they will be very honest with you and say, they didn't fight, So, we're not, I don't know that, I mean, I can tell you about everything up to the LLD, and then we took a lot of prisoners, and we didn't shoot too much. So I think that was the state of the union, for the American military as it got ready to go. When you assessed your unit, as you began to look at it and you began to go through these exercises, first of all, what did you get told in terms of these training exercises that you went up and did in 29 Palms? I would imagine that you did toots with the CPs of different units in addition to taking your unit up there. But what were you told your mission was going to be? And then how did that change the way you were getting ready?
Yeah, traditionally, first LAR Battalion has a general support relationship for 1st Marine Division. So just for, not to go down into the weeds, but 1st LAR, 3rd LAR, the Amtrak Battalion, and the Tank Battalion are all separate battalions. They report directly to the division commander. They don't fall underneath a regiment. The traditional 1st LAR role was general support of 1st Division. I mean, whatever task the CG assigns, that's what we're doing. And that's the way General Conway had played it in all of those scenarios, if I remember correctly. And 3rd LAR, kind of because they're co-located geographically with 7th Marine Regiment, they're part of, kind of have a standing almost RCT construct up there. So that RCT 7, is kind of the heavy punch. That's where the tank battalion is. They got their own LAR battalion up there. They, they they do get a practice, gets a practice probably more than anybody else doing the live fire support coordination. So, that was kind of the relationship. And I'll tell you, the day we did the change of command between General Conway and General Mattis pulled all the, lieutenant colonel commanders, regimental commanders to the mess. They just built this huge amphitheater, kind of big Star Wars looking building over there at One Mess. And, he talked to us and he's like, gentlemen, make no mistake. We are going to war. We're going to go to war with Iraq. And he had the map of Safwan Hill. And you know, he called it the Iraqi Jabal Sanam or whatever. He says that hill right there commands the view of the entire, you know, demilitarized zone between Kuwait and Iraq, and we're going to have to fight through there, and we're going to have to seize the oil fields and blah, 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 blah. And I mean, he's like, and everything we're going to do in this division is going to be based on fighting and fighting fast and being as lethal as we can and boom, boom, boom. And just, I mean, laid out the line. That was the summer of 2002. So, you know, my focus, it was kind of a difficult management set because we were manned at probably 85 to 90% of the enlisted strength. And, I would have to send out the companies to the BLTs. So at any time I could have, you know, I've got four line companies. A huge H&S company, and at any one time I could have at least two, if not three, companies attached out.
Right.
So here I am a battalion. I've got to make sure, though, that they are 100% of the equipment that they have assigned is good. All the people are assigned, so literally anything breaks, you know, I get the broken stuff at the battalion level, and I push to the BLT company the good stuff. So, like, holy crap, how am I going to go to war with one company and an H&S? And so the only saving grace was a table of organization equipment for LAR at the time was 24 LAVs. And, you know, we could only deploy the West Coast BLTs can only take max of, like, 16. So even though there were two or three companies, we would chop, you know, eight vehicles back. And so my predecessors had formed a non-organic weapons company primarily because they wouldn't take the LAVATs a lot, and we had the mortar variants and those kind of things. So and a bunch of the C-squares. And so I had a line company and an LA and an extra company, a weapons company. And we were like, okay, how are we going to do this? And as it turns out, I had, two of my companies were attached out, one of them was deployed and wound up doing the invasion, with, Colonel Waldhauser, General Waldhauser's 15th MU. And Don Tomich was the company commander there and, had to leave. Captain Lance Dowd, who was a great, great Marine. He was back with Lieutenant Colonel Boudreaux. Brian Boudreaux is now three-star general, PPNO. They were going to be the next West Coast BLT, and I just got back my Delta company. And so I had three organic companies, and we had an extra equipment set that was going to come off of the MPS suite in Kuwait. And so the company that literally had just returned after Westpac, like, all right, the rest of us are going to get on the Amphibious Task Force West. So they had seven or eight amphibs, and we First Marine Division loaded, First Marine Division minus loaded. So I was with First Marine Regiment reinforced. And we were going to sail over to Kuwait. Fifth Marines and a lot of Seventh Marines were going to fall in on the MPS equipment. And so I had people and equipment and everywhere. And because of the manning situation, I was in just getting equipment back from 6 months at sea. I was like technically non-combat effective, because you got to have man-trained,
right,
and, you know, cohesive crews to be certified. I didn't have any of that. None of it. You know, the best, the most trained company was the one that had just returned, and so we kind of put a non, you know, the Marine Corps put a, and I forget the exact term it was, but basically, like, hey, ain't nobody leaving. You know, you're going.
Stop loss,
and ain't nobody keeping it. So that's what saved us. But, you know, like, every month, you know, we're like, hey, when are they going to do that? When are they going to do that? And I would lose more and more NCOs, you know, PCS and then whatever. And, you know, because, you know, the Marine Corps, you know, nobody had made that decision until probably late that December of 2002.
Okay.
But I remember, hey, guys, it's going to go, and when the balloon goes up, man, you better be ready. And So,
Duff, in the lead-up, you're scrambling to get your equipment ready.
Yeah.
There's this influx and continued outflow of people. And so what do you say to somebody who says, well, the next time we go to war, you know, well, there's a buildup and things get stable? That's not the picture you're painting for me.
Oh, no. It was not at all.
So
it was.
It's going to be the state of flux until you fly off, and you're still going to experience flux after that, and you're in the midst of that. You're going to rely on your subordinate officers, your staff NCOs and NCOs to get that thing ready to go.
Yeah, and be comfortable with chaos and friction, because, man, that was filled with friction.
Saying chaos, you're not talking about General Mattis. You're talking about the event.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was. And we, you know, like, yeah, I remember he's like, hey, White, you need to be prepared to swim some rivers. It's a Tigris and Euphrates. And, you know, literally we would do, you know, semi-annual swim ops in the Del Mar boat basin.
Yeah.
You know, but we're like, this is probably not, that doesn't count.
Yes, sir.
You know,
I'm not sure how to tell you this, because I know you've seen the capabilities of the LAV.
Yeah.
But this bitch don't swim.
Yeah, it's...
It does in the commercial. Okay, but it don't.
And I tell you what, it gives you great appreciation for the Amtrak.
Absolutely.
And God bless those guys. And track vehicles can go where even eight-wheel drive vehicles can't go.
Right.
And
boldly.
It's a great capability. And but we wound up going to Fort Hunter Liggett to really test how do you enter rivers, how do you exit rivers. And my guys, we had this great captain, Bobby Whalen, who found I think the Seabees had this stuff called mobility matting, that you could roll out and keep you from bogging down entry and exit points out of, you know, off of the beach or off of the river. And we actually did, they had a lake up there, and, you know, we were swimming and shooting, because nobody had done that in our battalion. And, you know, set up target arrays on the other side and all that stuff. And sure enough, General Mattis says, hey, White, I'm going to fly up. You know, pick me up tomorrow. I'm going to spend a couple of days with your battalion. And I'm like, hey, sir, I don't have a vehicle for you. I don't give a shit. You know, we're going. And so, literally, I mean, it was, he was just in my vehicle, and we were going around, you know, circulating the training, and we go to one of the swim offs, and the first vehicle that's going to make this long, long, long swim starts to sink probably 200 meters from the near shore. And literally we hadn't even untied it yet. And I'm like, pull it back. And he's like, hey, why? What's going on? I'm like, well, sir, it's kind of, we're experiencing a little difficulty with that. He says, is that damn vehicle sinking? I'm like, yes, sir. He goes, what'll happen? Sir, it'll be at the bottom of that damn lake. We need to get, the match and everybody made it happen. They recovered and crew did great, and nobody lost their head, and I didn't lose my job. But that was kind of an inauspicious start there with General Mattis, but he's like, hey, that crap happened. Work through it. Get better. I'm like, absolutely, sir. And so, you know, and that's really what we were trying to do was just, you know, see what was out there and at least, you know, if the whole battalion couldn't be doing swim offs, at least we understood what it took at the battalion level to make that happen and how to facilitate those stuff. So, those are kind of some of the things we did. And then I will tell you that, when we got into Kuwait, and actually into Iraq, I was the only unit. They were like, hey, we got a bunch of new Marines, new 0311s. I'm like, does anybody want them? And at that point, they hadn't sustained a lot of casualties yet, but I was taking everybody that they could push our way just to flesh out my battalion. So I got healthier and healthier the as far as manpower numbers, you know, longer we attacked into Iraq.
Wow.
Just to offset the deficit. And I did get a company chopped to me from the reserve LAR battalion, 4th LAR. And those guys were awesome. Company commander was awesome. But a lot of them, you know, they're all, the reserves are all college students,
right.
Police officers, firemen, and they had probably the best crew cohesion. And I mean, hell, they would have some crews that were all staff sergeants.
Right. You know, it's not what you think. You know, you see these movies like, oh, reservists. And I don't say this because I deployed it as a reservist, but relative to the LAR units that I worked with, not only as a company commander, but at other times they were reserve guys, exactly as Duffy says. They're college students or cops or they're professionals, and they're older in the same billet, and they're more experienced in the same billet. And it was an interesting encounter when you watch them. You're like, damn, this is pretty cool. This is pretty cool. These are like, you know, like NCOs but on steroids. You know, they're, you know. So I had the same experience. Very, very, very interesting. Duff, let's fast forward just a little bit, but
sure.
let's go to map one and talk about the initial scheme of maneuver. You're in Kuwait. You've been looking at this problem for a while. Talk to us about the initial. We're looking at map one. Talk to us about the initial scheme of maneuver.
Yeah, you're looking at map one. I just closed it. Let me look at it again. Yeah. All right, let's see. Sorry about that, Frank. All right, so we're talking about the red plan, the initial set. Is that what you said?
Yeah, we're talking about map one. Yeah, the red plan, initial set, exactly.
Okay. Oh my gosh.
Or is it better that we look at map two? Because map two at least shows a little bit ultimately of what. So yeah, map one is just kind of general orientation to the laydown of units in Iraq prior to LD, and then so you can use that to orient yourself, and then if you go to map two, I think it makes it easier for you to explain the scheme of maneuver.
Yeah. All right, so we all, you know, the whole division, the whole crew is there in Kuwait, and I get assigned to 5th Marine Regiment, RCT-5, Colonel Dunford, and 100% of their regiment had fallen in on MPS gear. That one company that I had left back had flowed over with them, so they fell in on the LAR set that was in the MPS suite. And the rest of my battalion, they flew me, General Mattis flew me, some of my key staff, and Colonel Dowdy, who was CO of 1st Marine Regiment, and his key staff. We flew from Guam directly into Kuwait to continue the planning while, you know, our XOs and everybody flowed the actual units along with the ATF across the Indian Ocean. It was, you know, a long time. So, you know, every day, you know, the 5th Marines battalions are all reporting, hey, I'm at 50%, 55%, 60%, 70%, and here I am like, I think my guys are training on ship. I don't know. But we were planning and we were very focused. And General Mattis had us focused in on, they called the opening gambit. If you look at this map, they had pushed the 1st Marine Division into these, they called them LSAs, life support areas, I think it was. And each regiment had its own LSA, and at one point then, 1st Marine Division left a kind of a semi-permanent camp and moved out to its own Camp Coyote, I think they called it. And we were just in northern, in the desert. I mean, that was it. There was nothing else to do but get ready. They built some tents, and they had floors, but they, you know, it was cold as heck. They no air conditioning. Initially, no chow hall. A little bit of chow, I guess. You know, not much showers. And Colonel Dunford's like, "Hey, we're gonna live out in the sand. We're not gonna do any of this living in tents right now until we're ready to go." And so we were all focused on the opening gambit. And the 1st Marine Division objective, then you'll see the Romalia oil fields. They're listed on that map just north of the Kuwaiti border. That was, huge, huge complex. And if you go a little bit further to the east, there was a key node called Azubair, and that was the key pumping station. And then, the UK and the 15th MU were going to take Basra and Umm Qasr there to allow 1st Marine Division to go to the oil fields. And part of the concern was that leadership did not want, I guess national leadership did not want Saddam to start lighting off the oil wells like he had done in the first Gulf War. So it was going to be a rapid attack as humanly possible to get in and secure the oil fields. I think they're doing a lot of pre-D-Day shaping, deception, you know, leaflets, those kind of things to prevent units from doing that. From lighting them off. But that was, we planned that thing 18 different ways. And, 1st LAR's mission changed probably every 3 or 4 days in there. And as it turns out, the mission that we wound up having was, when we got the word on St. Patrick's Day, to go ahead and move up into our attack positions, the whole division, We all moved out at night, pre-dawn into, into movement. 1st LAR went to ours. It was kind of the lead of RCT-5, and we were kind of the northernmost RCT-5 unit. And then we wound up getting the word, I think it was probably the next day, to go in us to the west, 3rd LAR to the east, to go into the demilitarized zone between Kuwait and Iraq and establish a screen line. So we knew it was going to happen at that point. So we went in, we established a screen line, and we could observe Iraqi units and actions on the other side of the border. And then we got the word, hey, guys, tomorrow morning there's going to be bulldozers, and we're going to cut through the Iraqi fence on the Iraqi side, start filling in the berms and the tank ditches. And so we're like, all right, we think this is going to be game on. And sure enough, there were some minor kind of actions, started receiving some incoming and massive counter battery fires from our side, kind of silenced that. Hey, we see some guys over there planting mines, you know, hey, General Mattis, can we take them out? Absolutely. That's an offensive action as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, we engaged in, our mission was to pass, to establish lanes to pass, all the RCT-5, infantry units through. And they had 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines all together. We had an artillery battalion, direct support, and then we also had 211, and we had 2nd tanks with us. So it was a pretty formidable RCT.
Yeah.
But we weren't even the main effort for the division. The main effort, main attack was RCT 7 going to that Azubair main pumping station. At one point, though, RCT 7.
So Doug, if you could, give me the scheme maneuver as you guys are pointed essentially to the north. Start.
Yes.
I don't care if you start and go east to west or go west to east. Who's where doing what?
All right. So RCT 7 with 3rd LAR in front is to the east. They're the easternmost, 1st Marine Division unit. Then it's RCT 5 and us. To our rear is RCT 1 with 2nd LAR. Task Force Terra was an independent unit underneath 2nd MEB, and they were controlled, I guess, by 1 MEB. So they did not fall underneath 1st Marine Division, but they were also kind of to our rear and to our west a little bit.
Okay.
And they were going to attack while we were going for the oil fields. They were going to go attack and seize a river crossing there on the Euphrates in Nazaria.
Okay.
With the mission then to pass RCT 1 through them.
Okay.
So
ultimately, in this opening gambit, Duff, RCT 1 is going to ultimately be the main effort after the initial movements and the initial seizures.
Well, if I remember right, they were going to, it was going to, designed to General Mattis just wanted speed. Along with speed comes a lot of security.
Right.
And he knew when we had actually wargamed, going up that Highway 7 north of Nazaria all the way to Alcoot, if you look at that.
Okay.
That is just chock full of farms and streams, and you see the river that follows the road.
You bet.
We knew there was going to be a lot of cross compartment kind of slogging type movements. So we wanted to get them out there and get them going. And so I think, they were probably in the actual opening gambit, they would probably be considered the division reserve, but then as soon as we seized those, and they got on the trail of Task Force Tarot, and then we're going to pass through. So
okay. All right.
They were going to. So it was basically a two pronged attack.
Got it.
RCT 7 was supposed to then, I think, maintain the main effort and attack up Highway 1 roadbed towards initially Adiwanewa, and then towards Baghdad. But as it happened. If you'll look at where it says Romali oil fields, RCT 7 was to the east, RCT 5 was to the west, and I was actually, first LAR's mission, once we passed everybody through, was then to screen the division flank from the west.
From the west.
So we were set up on the western flank of the regiment, and then, it just made sense when we picked up the next morning to start the attack towards Adiwanewa. RCT 5 kind of took the lead.
Okay.
And, we always assumed at some point we would hit a hard point or something, and the RCT 7 would go continue. But it wound up really, Matt, it was from this point all the way to Baghdad, at least for me and my unit, it was a movement to contact. Every movement that RCT 5 made was a movement to contact. We think the enemy is this. We think they're disposed this way. We think we're kind of going to meet some resistance here, but we don't know.
Okay.
And
right.
So we would kind of two other things before we continue is while we were in that. The demilitarized zone, and we wound up, providing the screen force. When they started cutting the berms, the tractors did, they launched, I thought it was a Scud. I still don't know what it was. But the Iraqis launched a missile, and it looked like it went right over our head. You know, and you could hear the boom back, you know, where the meth guys were back in Kuwait. And next thing you know, we got the signal to go to Mach 4. So I'd always trained for Mach 4. You know, we were in Mach 2, Mach 3 up to that point. When you put those gas masks on and you're like, all right, I'm going to kill somebody for doing this. It's just, this is bad. You know, and I'm telling you, the first Iraqi army unit that we uncovered that had decided they wanted to live rather than fight us, it looked like the aliens had abducted them. And literally the entire uniform, rifle, everything was just dropped. And they had gas masks that were, I don't know who made them, but good gas masks. They had mop suits. They had nerve agent antidote kits. They were ready to fight in a dirty environment. And so the level of deception that Saddam had to portray that he had chemical weapons and was, you know, going to use them, in the fight. You know, I firmly believe that he had them and that he was going to use them when we started seeing that kind of stuff.
Right.
But eventually we wound up taking the gas mask off. But we were in Mach 3, Mach 2, all the way to Baghdad. And for those of you that have never lived in a charcoal suit for a couple of weeks, it's a special, special thing. And you get kind of right. But part of that was the time, you know, it's like, hey, if we were doing this in the middle of summer, we'd be crawling along with heat casualties and all that. So it's like, it's March. It's kind of cool. Let's go as quickly as we can. Because, you know, fighting that in that environment would get ugly real quick.
Yeah, you could. You can do. Well, I mean, it would only increase the casualties if you slowed the rate, right? That I'm sure that was a factor in the plan in the Big Blue Arrow type of planning. So we're looking at you. They're plowing through the berms, and you're getting ready to go. Talk to us real quick about your training. And what the Marines did is you guys are planning for all of this. What are the Marines doing? And at what point do you look around and say, we're ready to do this thing?
I tell you, for the LAB and any mech'd up force, you got to be able to fight your vehicle. And every day the mechs and the crews were killing themselves, getting the communications up. You know, if you're not communicating out there, you're hurting. But we were doing gunnery. We were doing, you know, all the immediate action drills, and Kuwait was a good place for that, where we could, you know, you could get a company online. And I think the more, even though we didn't have as long on the ground as the rest of RCT5 did, the crews really, you know, even though they got cohesive very quickly.
Right.
And so it was, you know, kind of living in the vehicles, maintaining the vehicles, getting comfortable with the idiosyncrasies of the vehicles and the weapons and all that. I think every day, you know, we're like, okay, we're more ready than we were yesterday. We're more ready. We're basically winning the day. Every day. And, General Mattis's, one of his main bumper stickers, right when he took over was be brilliant in the basics.
Right.
And that's really what we were focused on. Even though we're talking very complex meth, you know, the meth, fight was going to be the most air-centric Marine air camp, campaign ever. And 1st Marine Division was going to be the recipient of it. Because if you look at that enemy laydown, there were 6 or 7 divisions aligned against 1st Marine Division. And the way we had no intention of taking them on one at a time, basically they opened up these kill boxes around those enemy formations to allow the aviation, if they weren't answering, no kidding, troops in contact, kind of close air support calls, they were, you know, the big eye in the sky and the MEP were treading the, you know, the enemy up along, you know, that highway, six, I guess, it bends around the Tigris just to the north of where we were. And so, you know, you got all this stuff going on, and literally, I think the division at that point had almost 20,000 Marines and sailors and soldiers and everybody. But it was no kidding. You know, let's do our immediate action drills for our section, for our platoon, for our company. Companies, can you stop and pass through the company behind so we can continue to move quick? And, you know, it kind of took care of itself. I think had we gone 2 weeks earlier, we would have been, my battalion, it was just my assessment. I'm sure the Marines would have made me look good, but we needed every day that we had there to get ready to do what we were supposed to do.
So when you hear brilliant in the basics, that's not a theoretical expression for you.
Oh no. Yes. And that's, you know, just reinforcing with the Marines, you know, okay, why did your main gun just jam? Did you go through the checklist? Well, no, we've done it 100 times. You're like, stop. Do you think you're smart as a pilot, an F-18 pilot? Well, no, probably not. You know, they're college graduates and all this stuff. Yeah. What does the F-18 pilot do when it goes and gets into the cockpit? Goes through a freaking checklist. Why? So he doesn't miss anything. So he doesn't, you know, and so just trying to, you know, get the Marines to do those things, you know, just do their, you know, at-halt checks. You know, check the planetaries of the wheels. Are they hot? Okay. Look in the sight glass. Is it milky? All right, well, we need to drain the fluid and put more fluid in there, or else you're going to have a tire go bad. Next thing you know, it's like a horse throwing a shoe.
Right.
You know, you're not going to be able to fight your vehicle if your gun doesn't work, your paint gun especially, and your wheel ain't working. So it's just those kind of things. And if your crew can do those, make it part of their second nature where they're not even thinking about it, that's when you know you're ready for just about anything, in my opinion.
Okay.
And I was blessed to have Gunner Musselman and on my vehicle. He was my gunner, but that guy knows everything about LEVs, and his field craft and his vehicle craft are, you know, unmatched. And so, and that enabled me to be thinking battalion level thoughts, figuring out what the RCT and the division is doing while he was really guiding the actual vehicle for the most part, even though I was the assigned vehicle commander.
Yeah, you're doing other things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, and then we have, and then just for, so everybody knows, when you look at map one, actually, if you look at map two, map one is the overall scheme. But when you look at map two, you'll see that, you know, the Army's going to do the left hook, right? So and this is W was talking about speed. So the concept of much of the attack was to do this thing as fast as possible. It was going to teach the Blitzkrieg a lesson about what speed really was. And so so the scheme of maneuver. All right, Duff, let's talk about you guys. My guest today, we're talking in today's battlefield study, is the march up. And we're talking about the 1st Marine Division and one MAPS movement from Kuwait to Baghdad. So you guys are there. You're ready to go. Any final words to you guys before you go north? Any final things that General Mattis said before you went north that were important?
That's a good question, Mac. General Conway and General Mattis came out to all the LSAs and talked with the units when we knew that it was getting close, because and you know, your listeners probably know it better than I do. You know, there were a series of ultimatums at the national level from President Bush and all of them. Are you going to let the inspectors in? Are you going to do this? And are you going to do that? That was a lot of the discussion at the lower levels hey, are we really going or not? You know, and is the, you know, is the U.S. going to bow to the international pressure to not go, to let the U.N. flail around for some more or whatever? Like, hey, guys, we can't even think about that. We have to, you know, we have to believe, we have to get the mindset right now that we are going. And the only way we're going to go home is once we go through Baghdad. And to think anything else, you know, is, I think, just counterproductive to what we're doing and to get our mindset right. And those were kind of some of the messages as he went out. And literally, you know, he, General Mattis and General Conway went out and visited the LSA during the days right before we got the word, the final word. But literally, when we did get the word, General Mattis, I'm sure a lot of your readers have seen the letter that he put out to 1st Marine Division. Kind of has the blue diamond watermark in the background. But he had said every one of those things to my battalion probably not all at once, but I know every Marine that I had heard those words come out of his mouth at least once, if not twice. And then it was all reinforced in that letter. Clear, concise, right there, what we're doing, why we're doing it, what he expects, and, you know, if we can do that, we're gonna come out of this fight on top. And I learned that. I'm like, God, that's, you know, we're kind of hearing the same thing. No, I think we all needed to hear that, and we needed to hear it from the boss, and he needed, and that, he just didn't say that. He expected that, and he would, reinforce it. And so he wasn't just walking the talk. He was going to, talking the talk. He was going to walk the walk that synced up with his letter and what his intent was. So I think that did a lot to bring cohesion across the division in my mind.
If you've never seen the letter, it's included as picture two, in the attachments for this. And if you've never seen it, take a look at it. It's and the one thing everybody should know about General Mattis is if there's ever a guy who can portray it, it was Major General Mattis at the time. Marines, he's a charismatic guy. He loves Marines. He loves talking to them. He loves being around them. There's nothing he would rather do than hang out with young enlisted Marines and listen to their bullshit stories. And the other thing that he loves to do is he loves to motivate them. And if you've ever been around him when he's doing it, I won't say that he levitates because that's how excited he gets about it, but he gets fired up for it. And they love, he knows how to do it. Every time I've seen him do it, it's pretty incredible. Duff, talk about what it was like when he spoke to your guy.
Oh, I tell you, he can connect, and that's something I wish I kind of had. But literally, he can connect, like you said, as a two-star general to the Lance Corporal instantly. And they, you know, it was like, you know, almost a dog, you know, whistle. They were 100% listening, actually listening to it, not just, oh my gosh. And this was from the first time that he ever talked to our battalion. And he's not overly verbose, but what he says, you know, he feels, and it's from the heart, and it connects directly to Lance Corporals, and it is 100% about war fighting and being able to do our job. And, you know, he'll say without paying the heavy butcher's bill price and all those kind of things. And he, you know, next thing you know, he's talking about the great American experiment and how we need to be the ones to be, you know, and they're all like, absolutely. That's why I joined the Marine Corps, or, you know, and it kind of almost relights the fire, when he does talk, of those guys and reminds them why the heck they enlisted and went through boot camp and that the crucible and all that stuff. He has the ability to do that. I just say the F word a bunch and, you know, hey, let's go.
Hope it motivates him. No, but he's and here's one other thing. Nobody ever called him Mad Dog. All right. Nobody calls him Mad Dog. I don't know where that came from. Maybe somebody made it up, but in the division, his call sign was Chaos, and he was General Mattis. And again, a charismatic Marines, junior Marines, you know, they'd see him, and they'd be like, "Well, there he is," and he loved it. It's the letters labeled as Picture One in the slides that we have, the maps in the slides. Let's talk about the line of departure, Duff. How does it go? What are the major challenges as we're still looking at map number two as you head to the oil fields? How does that phase of the operation go?
It's now night. We start to pass the, and I forget which order the infantry battalions were passing through us, but we had established lanes as deep as we could, and about that time, General Mattis had an idea and actually had pulled the G7, Lieutenant Colonel Lukeman, Jim Lukeman, I think he's a two-star, three-star general now. He put him up in a P3 as kind of an airborne relay, and because we knew comms were going to be a challenge, especially on the move.
Explain to everybody what G7 is.
He was the general's first Marine Division. You know, they're normally like the inspector and the guy that does all these things. But Colonel Lukeman had just turned over one of the battalions in 5th Marines like 6 months before. We were going. So he was one of those guys like, oh my gosh, you know, we know we're going. And he's now all of a sudden not in command, but he wound up being kind of a special project officer, and basically, you know, General Mattis designed a unique role for him as a G7 to have an operational role. And as it turns out, that's the only way I knew what was going on was I was listening to Regimental TAC Net, the tactical net that Colonel Dunford was on. And he could get comms with Colonel Lukeman flying up in the P3, who could talk to see what, you know, RCT-7 was doing and what everybody in the division was doing. And this was, for your listeners, there were two digital communication devices that I had my entire battalion. My battalion is probably 200 vehicles. You know, let's say rough number, 100 LAVs, different types. And the rest were rolling stock in company combat trains, battalion combat trains, battalion field trains. So, I mean, it's a lot of heavy junk, refuelers, you name it, wreckers, recovery vehicles, all sorts of stuff that keeps a mechanized unit in the fight. And you know, you add that into three mech'd up infantry battalions, a tank battalion, and an artillery battalion. We had a lot of heavy junk and a lot of vehicles just in the hour. So we had to keep it as simple as possible, because when you're dealing with that mass on the move in kind of a unsure what's ahead of you kind of environment, if you try to get overly sexy or overly complex, you're going to be shooting yourself in the foot, literally. Pushed two Blue Force trackers. It was an Army device that the Marine Corps decided not to get down to our battalion. My fires vehicles had them, and like the Alpha Command and the Bravo Command, and that was the only way we had the bigger picture of what the Army was doing or what anybody else was doing. Everything else was radios. And it's a lot different than it is now, even for when I was in Afghanistan, right. Nine, 10 years ago. We had developed digital comms all the way down to the freaking squad level. you know, where at this point it was all radio. I mean, it was, you know, the regiment had and the division had digital comms, but it wasn't that reliable on the move. So we were kind of going off of intent. What's your mission? What's the intent? Okay. And, literally right before we kind of crossed the line of departure, we get an intel report that there was a 100 tanks, Iraqi tanks, an independent tank battalion had somehow slipped through everything and was going to meet 7th Marine RCT 7 in a meeting engagement up by their objective. And I'm like, all right, if that's for real, we're in trouble because these guys are a lot better than I think they are. You know, it turned out to be a totally bogus report.
Right.
But as the lead RCT 5 units started going, started encountering tanks. And so we could hear, you know, some tanks coming up, firing, shooting toes, you name it. And we're like, there's not supposed to be any enemy armor in front of us. And sure enough, then, you know, they would continue on, then the next battalion, they would engage some tanks. And you're like, what in the hell is going on? You know, this is going to be a slog, you know, slugfest, man. You know, third battalion goes up and it hits some armor. Well, turns out it was all armor that had been left out on the battlefield from the first Gulf War. But, you know,
right.
At night, on the move, you know, you see a, you know, a tank that's got a heat signature from, you know, you're going to shoot it.
Right.
And so we're like, holy crap. And, you know, and as it turns out, the battalions met with little resistance, although there were several Marines killed taking the objectives, but it wasn't as big a fight as we had hoped for, and we were glad of that, and we were, hopefully it was because of the speed and the shock of seeing, you know, a whole, you know, messed up regimental combat team coming down your throat that caused a lot of guys to say, you know, have second thoughts about fighting them. So that happens that night. We, you know, once the last units pass through our lanes, then we continue to establish the screen line out to the west. So we're just working all night. At this point, we probably hadn't slept in 3 or 4 days, I don't think, because of the work in the DMZ and the night before getting up to the attack position. And so, you know, here we are. You're already dog tired and you hadn't even done anything yet, really. And so the RCT 7 fight goes well. RCT 5 fight goes well. We get word that the Army had accepted the surrender of the enemy units in Nazaria. So they kind of shifted that MEF 5th Corps boundary to the south. And that's what enabled that Task Force Carol to go up. And Carol was going to go do a relief in place with the Army or just occupy and then pass through RCT-1. Well, guess what? The Army didn't go all the way in, apparently. And they just kept on moving because they were going across that desert to the west, south of the Euphrates. And, you know, that Jessica Lynch's outfit, that Army, you know, logistics outfit ran into the buzzsaw there on the outskirts of Anazaria. And then, you know, right on the heels of that, here comes Task Force Tarawa, RCT-2. And now they're in a fight to clear the city, to establish to seize the bridges to the north of the city to be able to pass RCT-1 through. And that's when there were some fratricide issues. I mean, it was a big, big verbal fight up there. And at that point, RCT-1 was south of Task Force Tarawa as I saw them, as we were then the lead unit of RCT-5, and we were kind of bypassing them to the south, going to hit back onto the highway and do a crossing of the Euphrates just to the west of Anazaria.
Okay.
And so the engineers had built an expeditionary bridge across, and as we were doing that, division had pulled 3rd LAR from RCT-7 Lieutenant Colonel Stacy Clarity, now it's Lieutenant General, I guess, got sent ahead of the, he was the lead unit across those bridges ahead of me, and he was in general support of the division, and I was still, 1st LAR was still attached to RCT 5.
Okay, so just so I understand, so Task Force Tara was at, is at Nasiriyah. Right, and so,
yep.
So the Ramal oil fields get seized. You guys continue to proceed essentially northwest. So you got Tarawa approaching Nasiriyah. You got RCT-1 behind them. You're screening off to the west, which you go to that mission. And then, and where is RCT-5 and where is RCT-7?
So RCT-5, you know, we get the word, hey, let's continue the attack and cross the Euphrates. The order of march within RCT-5 is, you know, 1st LAR first, and I want to say it was 3-5 was maybe second, and then all the way back. And so we just started moving, and we didn't really know that there was any fighting going on in Nasiriyah. I never heard that.
Okay.
What I heard was, you know, okay, 3rd LAR is going to bypass and get across and start screening this along Highway 1. You see that Highway 1?
Yes.
Just along the core boundary. That was not a fully prepared highway. Originally, it was not in 1st Marine Division's zone or the mess zone. It was in the Army's. And I think once they got some good, high-speed satellite pictures of it, it was not a completed highway from Nasiriyah to Adiwanewa. It was just kind of a graded roadbed that didn't even have culverts in there. So it was every place where there would have been a culvert or something like that, you had to, basically it was off-road movement, slow terrain, and just movement. And basically it was kind of an improved roadbed.
Okay.
Okay,
and then where's RCT-7?
RCT-7 then falls into the rear behind RCT-5.
Okay.
So now they become the kind of the mobile division reserve, if you will, because one's going to go up RCT-5. So those two arrows that split there, the blue arrows, you know, one going towards Al-Kut, that's eventually RCT-1 as it passes through Tarawa eventually, and then RCT-5 stays in the lead all the way to the Diyala River just on the outskirts of Baghdad.
Okay.
So
the order of movement is after the Ramal oil field is done, it's Tarawa is headed for Nasiriyah with RCT-1 behind them, RCT-5 behind them, and RCT-7 as essentially the division reserve. It's with the appropriate screening elements in there as well. Is that right?
Yeah, and really RCT-5, I think at that point was because it was oriented toward Baghdad. We were still the division main attack at that point, but we just had to get around Task Force Tarawa and RCT-1.
Okay,
when does
that happen in this kind of second phase? Now you're doing essentially the division movement to contact. Nasiriyah happens. When do you guys push through?
It was that second day.
Okay.
Mac, it was 3rd LAR moves. They're ahead of us now. The whole battalion gets across the bridge, and we're starting to cross. And it was funny. We had done a lot of work to do field expedient FARPs, forward arming refueling points for Cobras. And my air officer was talking to a section of Cobras that was kind of loitering, and we were very near the Euphrates. And he's like, hey, sir, those guys would like to, go take a look for us, on the other side of the river, if we can coordinate with 3rd LAR, just see what's ahead of us. but they're almost a bingo on fuel. So we're like, can we pull out the refuelers and refuel? So we did. You know, it was still kind of relatively open and flat down there south of Euphrates. So, you know, we gave the Cobra some gas, and then they went up, and they kind of did a visual recon all the way up that Highway 1 roadbed. And that's when they actually made contact. They flew over what they thought were civilians, but they noticed some kind of technical type vehicles, you know, the old pickup trucks with heavy guns mounted and stuff like that.
Right.
They were all in civilian clothes, but then, you know, they kind of do another pass to see what's going on. Then they got shot at. So now the Cobras, you know, do a couple of gun runs on these guys. And, you know, so we, you know, they report that back to us. We report it to division. Division's trying to push that word to 3rd LAR. And I, you know, because I didn't have time with 3rd. And so that's when we kind of got to realize that, all right, I don't know if these guys are going to fight us straight up or not. And, we had been briefed that they had the, Saddam Fedayeen and some Al-Quds, you know, guys that were gonna, you know, disrupt and attack. And that's actually, some of the 5th Marines units that reported to seeing that and engaging them there in the Ramali oil fields.
Okay.
So now we're crossing the bridge. We're continuing up Highway 1 and it's getting dark. And 3rd LAR gets into a huge fight. The entire length of their battalion, you know, so 4 companies were engaged with you know, Iraqis at close range, you know, on both sides of the road.
Right.
And
Doug, let me just ask you a stupid question. So
yeah.
3rd is still screening for the division, yes?
Yes.
So they're out in front of you. You're screening for RCT-5, right? And now you're through Nasiriyah on the map, and you're pointed up to Tigris, the Tigris River. Now is that the Tigris?
So we've crossed the Euphrates now,
right.
And we're in that Highway 1 roadbed.
Okay, with the Tigris off to the west.
Well, the Tigris to the north, really.
Okay.
You know, as it goes. So if you're looking at the map, we're kind of going towards Adiwaniwa. If you see that, that's kind of where we're going, and then.
Okay, hold on. But the arrow on the map points to Al-Qut. So you guys are on.
That's RCT-1. So RCT-1 is going towards Al-Qut.
Okay.
That's the supporting attack. The main attack is going RCT-5, led by 3rd LAR, then general support of the division is going up Highway 1.
Got it. Okay.
So that's the split. So, and you can see we're no longer mutually supporting positions.
Got
so
it.
I think that's why General Mattis then had RCT-7 that he could reinforce or flex either direction.
Okay, and RCT-7 is in trace of you.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. All right.
So now 3rd LAR is engaged in this massive fight, and
now let me ask you another stupid. Another stupid question.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
So 3rd, is it screening both forward of you and RCT-1?
Yeah, And screening is probably an imprecise term.
Okay.
Because it's night and it is dark as can be.
Right.
And we're on that. We're all on that Highway 1 roadbed.
Got it.
And because we are so near the Euphrates, the off-road terrain was very, very tough. And a lot of vehicles, LEVs, started sinking, getting stuck. And so it was really fighting up the highways. And it really did negatively impact even the tactical maneuver that we could do at the company and battalion level, much less at the regiment. Don't get the the idea, if you're out there listening, that, well, shit, why didn't you just bypass, you know, to the north? Just
yeah. Because that's
a 10-kilometer circle around and go.
Yeah. But, because when I look at the map, it's all tan.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was... But the Army, down there where the Army is,
yes,
you could go across the terrain. It wasn't, you know, that's kind of the desert that you have in your mind. But once we hit the Euphrates, it was green. I mean, I guess they call it the Fertile Crescent for a reason. It was farmland, and it was springtime. So,
okay.
I mean, it was...
So should people look at picture 2 to get a sense of what you're talking about, Doug?
Yeah, yeah. If you could scroll down to that and just see that picture is a little further north up along the banks of the Tigris River.
Okay.
But that's kind of the way it looked. It looked. I mean, and you were, you know, if you wanted to move fast, you were kind of, you know, doing a wedge with your lead units along the road. And, you know, it did provide, you know, the Iraqis had to deal with the same thing. So there wasn't a lot of counterattacks into our flanks. You know, so it was kind of, you know, SEC football, power dive right up the middle every day.
Right. And so that was simply no-go terrain. As you're doing your terrain analysis, and you were going to fight down that road, or die trying, and in terms of maneuvering off the road, that was simply was a non-starter.
I think we could have done it, but we'd be picking and choosing and going very slow, and that was, you know, remember
the
speed was of the essence, and I'm assuming that RCT-1 was kind of having a similar issue as they were going. But, you know, we're there. It's dark as can be. I'm standing right next to Colonel Dunford and his forward Alpha Command group. And 3-5 is right behind is the next unit. And we're talking to General Mattis, who's in his division. You know, jump CP. So he can be up. He was up there near somewhere. We couldn't find him. But he was there in some LABC squares. He was always very near the front, and which was good because he could see how dark it was and what the terrain was and all of that. So, you know, we're talking. I'm like, hey, sir, my battalion's ready to go. We can go up and link up with 3rd LAR and help him. He goes, hey, he goes, I still remember, he goes, Duffy, I know you can't, he said, but I really would like to get an infantry battalion up there with tanks because if it's something that 3rd LAR can't handle, you know, 2 LAR battalion, we might need some dismounted support in the tanks and so Sam Mundy was the 3-5 battalion commander, and he looks at Colonel Dunford and said, hey, sir, we can go, but we're low on fuel. And so I had my combat trains with Regional. I'm like, hey, sir, I can start popping off, you know, 3-5 right now to keep them going, to go up and link up the 3rd. And that's what they did. And that fight kind of dissolved, and I don't think 3-5 had to do any engagement that night, but the next day then 3-5 took the lead with their tanks. And, I want to say it was, we were going to go, into the defense that night. It was a regimental, imagine that, a regimental 360 defense with the road, with Highway 1. Is the 12 o'clock. Basically, 3-5 was going to have from like 10 to 2, and we were going to tie in 1st LAR on the north side of the road from, you know, 2 to 4 or whatever, and then 3rd LAR got pulled into RCT-5 at that point, and they were going to screen to the south of the road. And then, I mean, so literally you got thousands of vehicles in the defense at night with very, you know, poor terrain orientation features and things like that. And I think it was the next day after that, now a couple of days had gone on, that I don't know if you ever had that Brian Chontosh. He was a first lieutenant then.
Right.
3-5. He got the Navy, received the Navy Cross for running into these guys, I think, the remnants of the guys that had fought 3rd LAR. But literally, you know, 3-5's going in, and they get this close-in meeting engagement. And Chontosh is the, you know, the heavy guns platoon commander, and he's right there near the battalion jump. And you know, he drives the heavy guns, and him and his gunner, you know, start going right down the, you know, the line of the Iraqis that are attacking them, you know, shooting those 50 cals, and, you know, they all dismount and clear with enemy weapons and all sorts of, I mean, so it was,
yeah.
It was literally, you know, they were having that, you know, what's considered a high intensity engagement for them, but for the rest of the RCT, we might not have any engagements.
Okay, so if I can, so you're still south of Diwiniwa, right?
Yeah.
Right. And you're struggling to communicate. You're struggling to get a good picture of what's going on. Are you still eavesdropping on the P3 to find out what the hell's going on and where everybody is?
At that point, the RCT was all together, and we could communicate within the RCT.
Okay.
And General Mattis was in his jump near us. So the only big picture that I saw at that point was the RCT.
Okay.
And so I really did lose contact with what RCT-1 and RCT-7 was doing.
Got it.
And literally it became then just a movement to contact. And Colonel Dumper would put a new, you know, 1-5 or 2-5 in the lead the next day, and first was screening to the north as best we could, and third was screening to the south as best we could as we approached at Diwiniwa.
Okay. All right. Now, there's a few events I want to talk to you specifically. One, the dust storm. Talk to us about that. So in the middle of this fight, you know, around this time, right, you guys get hit with a dust storm. Describe that to people, and people say, well, couldn't you operate in it? So talk about that.
It was, we had one dust storm in Kuwait that literally, in broad daylight, you couldn't see 5 feet in front of you. And imagine if you didn't have, you know, in the middle of the tent camp, you could kind of stumble over and see something like, all right, here's a tent, I'm reoriented. But you could get so disoriented so quick. It's almost incomprehensible if you've never experienced it. And so we got the word that, hey, there's a storm coming through. And 3-5 had that fight, 3rd LAR had that fight. And we get a call to a regimental RCT-5 orders group, all the battalion commanders. So me and my wingman, we drive up. It's starting to get really bad, and they haven't even set up the sickups tents yet. And so we jump inside their command tracks, the Amtraks. And, you know, it's basically, you know, Colonel Dunford, his OPSO, and XO, and then the battalion commanders. We're all in there figuring out what we're going to do. We get the order. Okay, let's execute. And we opened up the back hatch of the track. And within that hour time frame that we were in there talking, probably visibility had gone down to almost zero. And we're like, holy crap. You know, we're not going to be able to execute this for a while. And we're like, oh my God. And so I was able to get back to my vehicle with Gunner Musselman, and we're calling back to the battalion, because we're up there with 3-5, I think, within the lead, and literally it got worse and worse until it started raining, and it was like it was raining mud out of the air, it was the weirdest thing I'd ever seen. That before it started raining, the static electricity was such that there were arcs going in between the antennas, and the LEDs at the time had two antennas on the back. And Colonel Musselman reached back towards it, and there was a huge arc, and it shot him. It was like a mini explosion. And it knocked him out, and he fell straight down in the gunner's chair. And I thought he was dead. I thought he was going to have to restart his heart or something. But then he started moaning. I'm like, what in the hell? He's like, I don't know. And it was just craziness. And about that time, the rain happens, and it kind of starts to clear up a little bit. And we get reports that enemy are going to counterattack down the road. I'm like, oh, my God. There's no way they're going to. They're like, hey, they're coming. And so 3-5 says, hey, I need some tanks up here, platoon of tanks up on the road. And so now here I am in LAV, and we're oriented in the direction. There's two of us LAVs right on the roadside, oriented right where those tank platoons going to come, you know, reinforced from an enemy counterattack. We're like, holy crap. It's going to be the first thing that they see. They're going to blow the shit out of us. And so, you know, we're like swapping all the time. Hey, there's a lot of armored vehicles, including LEVs up here. You know, keep your gun turned to the rear until you get up to the lead platoon, you know, lead company of 3-5. And luckily they did. But, I mean, you're not going to reach out and touch the tanks as they were driving past us.
I don't know that people understand how scary that kind of stuff is. Trying to do passing people at night, you can't see shit. They're nervous, you're nervous, everybody nervous, and you have live rounds loaded in the chamber because they kill indiscriminately. It doesn't matter if you're red or blue on the Blue Force tracker. They kill whatever that it gets pointed at. And you know, that kind of stuff is absolutely terrifying to do. And you know, you say that, you know, like you describe these things, and I don't know that you're doing a pretty good job, you know, trying to make it sound reasonable, but if you've never seen a dust storm, and it's literally unbelievable to look at in this part of the world. You guys get going, right? And talk to me now about getting going, and then what happened, and then what happened next?
All right, so we get going. The storm's over. We wound up. We had a bunch of enemy prisoners of war. We passed them to the logistics units. RCT-5 keeps going, and if you look, there's an intersection just to the east of Adiwaniwa. We get up to there, RCT-5 does, and we go into the defense there. And unfortunately, we're going to go into the attack pre-dawn the next morning. And as vehicles are pulling in and out to get refueled, there was an engineer vehicle that was with 3-5 armored combat earth mover. Got off the road and ran over and killed the battalion XO who was sleeping on the ground. I was on the north side of the road. I was probably within 150 meters of that when it happened. It's just horrible thing. You know, hey, we're in the attack the next morning, within another hour. And so I want to say it was 3rd LAR was going to go first. And at this point now, it's a real highway. And from that intersection, you'll see a shorter arrow that points to another road. And that road kind of bends back towards Anumanaya. Do you see that? Still in the one zone.
Okay.
That Highway 27, okay. And in between that little lake, about midway on that road, is the Saddam Canal. There was a main crossing that General Mattis was concerned that we needed to take, because if they dropped that bridge, you know, it was going to just delay our attack. So 3rd was going to attack all the way up to that intersection there, and that's called the Hantouche intersection. And then 1-5, gosh, I'm blanking. 1-5 or 2-5? 2-5 was the next unit, and they were going to secure that road, Highway 27, and then my battalion was going to bypass then to the, pass through 2-5, seize the crossing of the Saddam Canal, and get as far as we can to Anu Minaya. And now the enemy force that's up here is the Al Nidal Republican Guard Division. And 3rd LER's in the fight, 2-5's in the fight, and we're literally about to pass when division stops everything. Stop. All action stop. Move back. Reset. You're going into an operational pause. And Colonel Dunford was up near us in his jump so he could see what was going on. And, you know, we really had no idea, but I think it was, you know, this was something crazy from the National Command Authority level, you know. And so we had to stop right in the middle of all of that. And then Colonel Dunford, you know, now we're you know, like, holy crap, it's going to be dark soon. What are we going to do? And when we had left to go into the attack, 3-5 was the rear unit, as it was, you know, the rest of RCT-5 was kind of inching up towards that Hantouche intersection, and they had bad guys come out of Abdiwaniwa to attack 3-5. 3-5 shot artillery and air and all sorts of stuff on them. And so now, you know, Colonel Over's like, I guess the best thing we can do is go back and reoccupy the exact positions that we were all in the night before. And, so he's like, 3-5, you stand firm. You're the base unit now. 1st LER, you pass back through 3-5 and you establish, your portion of the defense. And as it turns out, you know, so we're going, we, you know, okay, we know where we were. All right, guys, let's do same company order. And as we're getting up there, the company commanders are like, hey, you know, this is where 3-5 was in the fight with those guys. So they dismounted scouts to make sure that everything was clear and we weren't going to, you know, get a couple of, guys pop up out of the spider hole with RPGs and, right, you know, kill a vehicle. Right. And, one of our scouts actually stepped on a bomblet, a DPICM bomblet. We think it was, you know, ones that, you know, the ground, you know, those things are dud producers anyway. Right. That ground was soft enough where, you know, he stepped on it and it went off. And so now in the middle of all of this, the whole RCT is trying to reposition, get back in the defense. I've got a seriously injured Marine. And so we call for the medevac, and it doesn't come, and it doesn't come. We're calling. I'm on the radio with the regimental XO. And the problem was the CH-46s were being used for the medevacs. And, at that point, they were having to come from the boat in Kuwait. Look how long that is. And there was a couple of FARPs maybe down by Anazaria by then. And they might have even been down there, but it just took too long. And they, you know, they picked the Marine up and wound up, he died in flight back to the, you know, whatever medical unit they were going to go to, just loss of blood. And I think you have that picture of the memorial service we did the next day. But literally, you know, we're still occupying the defense, sweeping through, make sure that, you know, we're not going to get any surprises. And we become kind of the base for the rest of RCT-5 to put back into their positions from the night before.
Got it.
And then, we wind up, there's a couple of days we kind of try to keep the enemy off guard. We do some aggressive patrolling. So, you know, down that road, make sure the highway, they're not doing anything the highway. And one of the days I was doing that, I had the aces come with us, and we were chopping down the, they're almost like little anti-tank, big metal girders in between the two sides of the highway. I said, let's cut a hole every, 500 feet or so we can, LAVs can go back and forth between the two sides of the highway if we have to maneuver back and forth, or else we'd have been kind of channelized along just one side of the highway.
Right.
And, we finally get the word like, hey, let's go. We're going to attack the seas, and New Manaya, the bridge crossing in New Manaya, over the Tigris. And that highway just to the north that goes along the north side of the Tigris is Highway 6. And so the scheme of maneuver was going to be second tanks was going to lead that attack through New Manaya, and then get on Highway 6 and attack towards Baghdad to the to the west. First LAR was going to be second in the order of movement there. We were going to go along this just kind of an improved road on the south side of the Tigris River. And Colonel Dunford said, we just don't know what's on either side of the road, really. And he would like to have the ability to shift left or, north or south of the road and not just be doing what we had been doing. Hey, there's only one road. They know exactly where we're going. Let's just punch our way through the middle. So he's like trying to give us more options.
Got it.
We do that.
So tanks are on Highway 6 and you're on, what do you call that road that went up
it was a power line road. If your guys look on, map number 4?
Yes.
Mac, this is out of the 1st Marine Division book, No Better Friend, No Worse Enemy. And that kind of shows, you see New Manaya, you see the red line there where Highway 6 goes. And so we're to the south. And the whole idea was, First LAR needs to try to keep abreast with the lead units of tank battalion and kind of, make a coordinated movement to the northwest towards Baghdad to keep the enemy off, off track as to, what the main attack is going to be. Well, our, second tanks goes like a buzzsaw. If any of your readers, or listeners have never been behind a tank battalion in the attack, it is a very good place to be. I would not want to be on the receiving end of that. But I'm telling you, those guys from second tanks were doing some fighting. And, it was pretty impressive. The problem was, everybody behind them, Colonel Dunford's command group and all that weren't in tanks. And so now you're going through hornet nest after hornet nest, schwacking it, and you're not killing all the hornets. And so now you're like trying to get those tankers when they're full on mode to slow down, was difficult. And now, and I'm only kind of picking up half of this conversation, of what's happening to the north. All I know is we start, we had some engagements before we made the turn onto Power Line Road, but it was kind of remnants of those units that second tanks had busted up. And so we're going down Power Line Road. It's literally, it's company columns. So my lead company is all 24 of their LAVs, and then my forward CP, mobile, and then the second, third, fourth companies are all behind, and we're all going down. And I think the first picture, Mac.
Right, picture number one is of this part of Power Line Road and the Tigris River, right? Picture number two. Picture number one is General Mattis's message. Picture number two is this area that Duffy's talking about. That's Power Line Road and an engagement that you got in with the Cobras and LAVs.
Yeah, so literally the lead platoon of the lead company has a no-kidding meeting engagement with entrenched, you know, Iraqi fighters that want to fight. They didn't have any armor, but they had, like, heavy guns, RPGs, you know, there was a bunch of them. And they open up close range with a platoon of LAVs. And I'm back, you know, obviously a couple kilometers, and I can kind of move up along the side of the road to get a viewpoint of that. I'm further back than that picture was taken. That picture was taken, I think, from, like, where the company commander was.
Got it.
But we're trying to maneuver other, you know, he's trying to maneuver other platoons up so they can, you know, bring their direct fire weapons on them. At the same time, he's starting to shoot his company mortars. We had a battery of Hardy 155, towed 155 with us. We get a hip shoot from them. They start shooting in artillery. The four LAVs immediately go open with their, you know, 25 millimeter chain guns, start shooting the pistol mount 7.62. Now here's, you know, 81 mortars coming in. Here's a second platoon shooting at them. Now here's 155 already coming in, and Cobras check in on station. They do a couple of gun runs, and now F-18s are coming in. I think that the F-18s just dropped a bomb danger close there. But all of that was within, like, a, you know, very short time frame. And, you know, if you look at the field, we were trying to maneuver the second company to cut them off. But, you know, the vehicles were getting stuck. And I mean, it's farm field. It's pastures and, you know, just old dikes and stuff like that. It was very cruddy movement anywhere except for on the road or on the roadbed. And so I'm talking to Colonel Dunford. You know, Second Tanks is having great success. And he's like, hey, W, are you going to be able to push through that? I'm like, yes, sir. Well, you know, no problem. But I just don't know what's on the other side of that. And I, you know, if we had been reporting all along, and we're trying to find river crossing points to connect to, you know, to be able to cross if we had to.
Back over to Highway 6.
Yeah, to cross over to Highway 6 and all of those. That's what the other companies were doing, where they were trying to find, you know, crossings of the Tigris to get into Highway 6. And finally, it's getting later now. Colonel Bummer's like, hey, stop. You know, Highway 6 is viable. You know, you've done your job. I want you to retrace your movement back to Andumanai across the bridge, and then get on Highway 6 and come up and join us. You'll be taking the lead tomorrow in the attack. And so, literally, that's what we did. We had to make that long move. You know, reverse the herd, move all the way back down power line, cross Andumanai, and then go wind our way all the way through up RCT5. And it was at that point I saw we had stopped, and right up ahead of us was a burning M1A1 tank. And I'm like, holy crap. I've never seen that before.
Right.
And part of the problem for us to keep the pace that General Mattis wanted was, you know, it's hard to get fuel up there, you know. And so they had these 70-gallon kind of fuel bladders that were gravity-fed that were on kind of on each of the tanks. And they could basically give themselves one refuel on the move. So they would roll it off, put the hose from the fuel cell on the ground into the fuel tank, and then drive over it. And gravity would just push the fuel into the fuel tank. Well, what had happened is one of these fights, the enemy machine guns or small arms fire had penetrated this fuel cell. It was still on top of the tank. It got sucked down in the intake of the engine and just lit it all on fire.
Nice.
Luckily, the, you know, M1 B-1A1 was made for the crew to survive that kind of stuff. So, but it was still like, holy crap, what's going on up here that they're killing tanks and I'm just in an LAB, you know? And,
how long does that movement take?
It seems forever, but it's probably 4 or 5 hours. Now it's dark, and 3-5 is now in the lead, and they are in a huge fight. And Colonel Dunfer wants me to come up and get with his jump. So we drive our way up with my forward CP, and I dismount and go find Colonel Dunfer, and we talk. In this whole time, he's kind of giving me the order for the next day, you know, 3-5s in the big fight. And they literally, you know, had
Hey, Duff, on map 4, yeah. Where's 3-5 in this fight?
I think they would probably be up around Sarabati.
Okay.
Sarabati.
Okay. All right. Now, my intention was to... not my intention, but this goes on for another hour and a half. So what we're going to do is we're going to pause, and then we'll wrap up the show for today. If you just slammed your head, your arms on your desk, and you have to hear the rest of it, just go to the Battlefield Studies page. Part 2 is there. If not, we're going to call it a day after this break. We'll reset the program. More of All Marine Radio on a Wednesday, Battlefield Study with Duffy White. Part 2 will play next Wednesday, and then what I'll do is I'll see if he can come on live because I've got some questions because we recorded this. I have some questions for Duffy about some of the things the battalion did. So don't touch that dial. All Marine Radio continues on a Wednesday right after this.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
That'll do it on a Wednesday. It never ceases to amaze me that I try to stick within the time frame that I allot myself for these things. I can't, though. I love military history. I love Marine Corps history. The stories about, you know, things you read about that sound easy in a newspaper article, the reality of doing them on the ground, vastly, vastly different. So for me, that stuff's always fascinating. So my thanks to Duffy for giving up his time. And part 2 will air next Wednesday. And then we'll see if we can get Duffy on after that to answer some of the email questions that I have for him. So, have a great day on a Wednesday. All Marine Radio is over. And out. Oh.